I want to put this word on the board up here. Actually, I'm going to put two words. It's in the first verse in the first chapter. In Genesis 1:1, in the beginning God created the heaven, Shamayim, and the earth. In Hebrew, if you wanted to, try to explain the unexplainable, you would draw a circle and just let that circle represent infinity or eternity, or you could say it just represent timelessness. So George is talking about a nanosecond. There is no nanosecond in that. It's always now. So when you try to put it in a nanosecond, you reduce it to the thing we call time. And in this, there is no such thing as time. It doesn't exist. God is. That's really the simplest and most complicated way to say it, because you sit there and try to figure that out, and it can't be figured out. It can't be really be explained necessarily. All it can be is just accepted. And when you accept it, you just receive it. You open yourself up, and that's a difficult part for us, because our mind already is working in time. And in time, we try to figure things out or put things in categories or put it in certain places so that we can, it's like filing it in your mind so you can go back and bring it back as recognition. But when you draw the circle and you put a dot in the center of it, which is the monad, and it's, in Hebrew it's called Ein Sof. Ein Sof. And there are several words that in Hebrew, before you get to any number, like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, etc., or any alphabetical letter, before you get to any of those, you have to start from this. So you start from nothing. They call it the vast no thing, no thingness, which is called the Ein Sof. And from the Ein Sof, you have the Ein Sof-er, which would mean the great nothingness of light. You can say or. So that everything that is because of light. And then we take things such as the scriptures or ancient scripts or any kind of other writings, and then we try to use symbols to explain what the light is, when really you can't explain the light. So the biggest symbol used is our sun for us. Okay? And so when we use our sun, we use it as a symbol of what light is. Because really, what the sun does is it emanates. And that word emanates is where you get the word said. It doesn't have anything to do with speech as we would understand speech in Genesis 1, because said is mentioned 10 times, and the word said actually just simply means the emanation of light, or it means that light is proceeding. Our energy is coming forth. And that energy, of course, has behind it the intelligence of the all. So it's perfect. It's symmetric. It's harmonic. I mean, it's just, there's nothing about it that can go awry or actually go out of function. And so the whole universe, which the word is a conundrum. Uni means one, verse means two or more. And so the only way that you can have a universe or energy is that God has to reflect itself from itself, i.e. God has to divide himself. So out of nothingness or out of one, out of the vastness, you create duality. But duality is not duality like we think of duality. Duality is just two-ness that is a reflection of oneness. Sorry about all these ness words. And so when you have heaven and earth, you have those two phrases in Hebrew, Shamayim and Eretz. These two words represent this duality that is really a unity. It's the only way that God can see itself. It creates a mirror. And you and I happen to be that mirror. The earth, the universe happens to be that mirror that God looks at to see what God is. So that God can experience itself, God created this, what we would call duality. And so duality is not wrong. Duality just simply is. It's the two sides of oneness, or of one. It's the two sides of this monad. And the only way that you can understand this, or the only way that you can try to understand it, because a natural mind really can't understand it, you have to allow Spirit via revelation to show it to you. And then you don't necessarily understand it, you just see it. Have you ever seen anything you didn't understand? A lot of things. You see a lot of things that you don't understand. You can watch the universe. One of the things that science don't understand is they see how the universe, how solar systems dance with each other and don't collide and don't run into each other. They cannot understand that. We can't understand that. We have always thought that they're going to collide and so they will destroy themselves. So it's where we get the idea of rebellion or chaos. But that all that rebellion or chaos is all a physical term. And it's not necessarily right or wrong. It's how magnets work against each other. Y'all remember when you were little and you would take two magnets and you'd push one around and never touch the other? You remember how you did that? That's resistance. That's rebellion. That's how this system in the earth works. So I said all of this about the light, the earth, the emanation, the things that's coming forth from God, to give you the duality of heaven and earth and to show you something right here with this word, Shin, which is the letter that represents 300. It takes us back into cosmic energy, or back into God. It's also a letter, can be referring to fire. There are two Hebrew letters that can refer to fire. It's the Shin and the Resh. The Resh is 200, and it also can refer to fire. Now, God is a consuming fire. Now, we all have been told that when you're cast into the lake of fire, you're cast into a pit called hell, or a place called hell. But when you really begin to look at ancient texts and scriptures, a place of called hell was a place that was really frigid, cold, extremely cold. Everything that was out of fire always represented God. And so really to be cast into the lake of fire would be to cast into the very presence of God, which God is a consuming fire. And the reason that you are cast into this lake of fire, or this consuming place, is that God consumes all of the things that you and I have measured as error, mistakes, all of those things. In other words, God has a unique ability to handle these things. And so we have built such a forest of religion and of these beautiful truths that are just present. They're right before us. And so the duality that God created was heaven and earth. And they weren't never separate from themselves and never were intended to be separate from themselves. And so when you are trying to explain this Ein Sof or the Ein Sof Er, when you're trying to explain this nothingness or this eternality, they reduced it to the first letter in the Hebrew alphabet. And the first letter in the Hebrew alphabet is like this. And this letter is called the Aleph. A-L-E-P-H. And it represents number one. And so it is a symbol. This letter is a glyph. It's a character of this, of the vast nothingness. You can call it the zero. And so the Aleph also, being number one, is a symbol of this. Now, when I say it's a symbol of this, to spell the word heaven in Hebrew, you have Shin, Mem, Yod, Mem. Or in other words, it would be Shin, letter number 300, Mem, which is the word or letter for water, material, mother, matter, etc. Mariner, marine, Mary, Martha. All of those come, Moses, all of those M words come out of this Hebrew glyph called Mem, M-E-M. And it's symboled by the number 40. And that's the reason that you always see 40, 400, 40 years, 40 days associated with trials and tests. Because anything in the physical, material, water, dimension works on that kind of restriction or striction or that causes tension. It just works that way. It's not right or wrong. It's not good or bad. It's not good or evil. It's not God or the devil. Those are all religious concepts and ideas that really got us screwed up, i.e. way off the track. So far off the track, many times it's hard for us to look at the scripture and try to see what was it saying. Because it was never a history book. It never was intended to be. It was always a mystery book. And by the term, when I say a mystery book, mystery just simply means the things that are secret. And the things that are secret weren't necessarily meant to be secret. But they were meant to be revealed in increments or through initiation, piece by piece, point by point. Can you understand what I'm saying?
So, when you look at the 40, you look at the 40-year segments of Moses' life, and you're understanding this at this level, now, that story is talking to you about the Trinity aspect of the duality.
It is. It is. It is such a beautiful, exhaustive. I do not think that we can truly exhaust the depth of the first five books of Genesis, or of the Bible, of the first. We call them books of Moses. I don't think that they can be exhausted. They are so deep because each story has such depth to it that we continually dig into it and continually we will see. We will get fresh manna every day from it. It's just that deep. When you make it a history, you have totally destroyed it. You've totally put it in a place of time, and it's a timeless piece of material. And so by doing that, even though if you do it so slightly, you have caused error to come to it. And so I want to talk about the Aleph, which was the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet, and always is a symbol of God. And the way that this word is described and designed, I wanted to read it out of an ancient Hebrew book that I've got, but I didn't bring that book. And this Aleph, this letter, is the body of the Hebrew word Shamayim. This word Shamayim, dealing with the Mem, Yod, Mem. This one is the final mem, and it represents the letter 600, which 6 is the number for humankind or mankind. And to take it to 600, it takes mankind into his cosmic or spiritual being. And so this Aleph, with its design, where it has a yod and a yod with a vav, this number 6 is called the vav or wav. And that's kind of how it's designed. And so when they use this glyph of number 1 to represent God, the way that God represented himself was he said, the waters which are above the waters and the waters which are below the waters. And that's how this word heaven, it never was meant to be anywhere other than here. That's such a difficult pill to swallow, because people are thinking that heaven is where I have to go to. Heaven is where mama is at. Heaven is where grandma and grandpa are. And it is, but they're not there. They're here. Because heaven's here. It ain't there. if you understand what I'm saying. So, when it says it's as close as the mention of your name, it's closer than the bat of an eye, it really was meaning that simply to say, it's here. You're surrounded by it, and it surrounds you. And so, once we begin to understand that, Genesis 1, I think it's 5 and 6, when it talks about the waters above and the waters below, it was actually expanding on this word in the first verse, heaven. Trying to give us a clearer understanding, because all you have to do is look at the word in Hebrew, and then you begin to, as you just kind of meditate or muse on each glyph, not trying to make it a word, but try to make it or understand it as a formula, a glyph of this cosmic energy of the En Sof Er that's emanating. It's coming forth inside me. It's coming forth to me. It's coming forth through me. And so as I do that, it begins to change my world. And I realize I'm saying some things sometimes hard for us to chew and swallow. I guess I would say the best way to chew and swallow what I'm trying to say is to meditate. And that becomes very complicated, because we don't know how. And because we don't know how, would actually make it better, because when someone teaches you their method of meditation, and there are many, and none of them wrong, what you try to do is adapt yourself to that which is working for them, and that may not work for you. So when I talk about meditation, I'm just talking about a method to steal your mind. A method that you can find that will help you quieten your mind down and experience the stillness. Because it's in the stillness is where the En Sof is at. It's in that place of silence, that place of no mind, that place of no thingness. That's where God is. It's in that place, that thundering voice, that raging fire, lunges up outside your being, from within your being, but not from without your being. When I say it lunges up outside of your being, I'm not talking about it's out yonder somewhere. I'm talking about it's inside you. I'm talking about that's where God is. Now, I'm not saying God's not out there, because there's nowhere God is not. So there's not anywhere that he needs to go.
So many stories, not just biblical stories, but 300 in heaven.
Yeah.
The mythical story of the Spartans and the 300. Mm-hmm. Now go back and look at that story.
Yeah. This is in all cultures. See, this is not unique to Hebrew. This is unique to all cultures, because They all understood a perennial philosophy, which is nature philosophy. When you talk about nature philosophy, perennial philosophy, it's not only that which is growing around us in the animals, in the trees, in the plants, in the insects, in the birds. It's that which is coming forth to us from the heavens, from the star systems, from the planet systems, from all of that that's out there, and this that's here, it's all merged, it's married, it's one. And what we do is we separate it. We've separated it, and in separating it, we misunderstand it. And then what happens? We divide ourselves against ourselves. And that's what causes chaos. That's what causes many times the things that go awry in our bodies. So I want you to go with me to the book of Exodus, if you would. Exodus chapter 25.
Lance, if you look at that Ali's symbol there, it puts me in the mind kind of your stick man, where you put the little diagonal mark there on the heart chakra.
Yes.
It's like you've got your upper nature and your lower nature.
Yes. Yes.
And that's exactly...
Yes, yes, and you are exactly right. When you can understand this, out of this Aleph, I can draw my stick man and I can show his lower nature, which is his from his heart. And the key of all of this I'm talking about, it hinges on this one word, and we have just grossly misunderstood that one word. That word is called soul. And we're going to work with that and get back to that. And it goes back to the stick man, everything. It goes back to that heart chakra or that soul center where the duality of humanity comes into play. But when I talk about the duality of humanity, I'm not talking about duality as division. I'm talking about duality as one, i.e. spirit and flesh, God and man.
And that heart chakra, the places where
overlap, that's where you get the Trinity part of the duality. That has to be one. Spirit, ego. And the only way that is one is spirit is soul linked to soul. You cannot separate them or divide them. However, soul is so designed to be egoic, you cannot separate it or divide it. And I realize that most people are trying to get rid of the ego, and you don't want to get rid of it. What you want it to do is serve you. You want it to become your servant. You want to become the master of it. That's your work. That's your journey. You're on your path. You may not know you're on your path. No matter where you're at in your physical journey, you're on your path. When you wake up and you realize you get to choose the path, that's when you begin to cause the ego to begin to serve you. If you don't wake up and realize you can choose your path, you let your path choose you, it will produce a lot of chaos in your life. And it always does. And it's the only reason it's doing that is simply because of the duality of the nature of cold and hot. And it's not right or wrong. It don't feel right, maybe. A lot of times I feel, well, this feels wrong. But the only reason it is because the path is choosing you. You're not choosing the path. And in Hebrew, there are two words for path. One is a path that deals with the masses and everybody's on it. And it just simply is just like the interstate highway. They're just going to and fro and they're really confused. And the other one is a path that has to do with your very private solo journey. Nobody's on it but you. That's why it's only you who can figure out your method of meditation. For some, it's music. To listen to certain types of music can put them in a meditative state. For some, it's to watch a candle. For some, it's to listen to certain sounds. For some, it's water, listening to a brook, etc. There are so many ways. Some, it's the practice of the oh. And all you do when you do that, you are sounding through your vocal system, through your throat, you are sounding the five vowel points, which are, those vowel points are what you mix together with these Hebrew glyphs to give you a word. And a word is just an expression of this beautiful energy of Ein Sof Er.
And at times, times I found myself with every one of those genders being what I need.
Exactly, exactly. And they all can resonate. So, I'm saying, I'm not trying to teach anything contrary to your favorite guru or any Eastern religion. I'm not, because they're all right. They are not one fighting against another. They're all trying to teach us or show us, find your path. Find that which is going to work for you, and then you do the work. So it's the great work where you begin to take this ego and let it serve you. You use it instead of it using you. Because I promise you, it'll use you. It enjoys that. It's designed to enjoy that. And it's not wrong. It's just that's how it's designed to work. So it works in such a beautiful, beautiful way. Okay? So here in Exodus 25, I want you to look at a couple of verses with me. Verse 9, it says, "And according to all that I show you after the pattern," everybody say the pattern, "the pattern of the tabernacle, and the pattern of all the instruments thereof, so shall you make it." And then look at verse 40. It says, "And I looked, and look, that you make after their pattern which was shown you." Everybody say shown. This word shown in Hebrew is ra'ah. Ra'ah. Y'all can say that. Yeah, kind of roll the R. Ra. Can you do that, Jamie? Ra. You got to roll the R with your tongue. You can do that, can't you, Rachel? Ra. Ah, now this is an important thing. I'm making it funny because I want it to stick with you. Ra'ah. It showed you. Now, when you think of that, when you read it that way, what you are associating with in your mind is a show and tell. It's a flannel graph board. It's God stuck this in front of him and said, here's how, here's how, and here's how. That's not what this means. That's not what ra'ah means. The word ra'ah actually means to experience. Now you have to understand that sometimes you may not have been shown anything, but you have experienced something. Got me? You understand? So what he's saying here, what I want you to do is I want you to understand your experience with this pattern that I presented in the mountain, in this peak or this high point or this place where you are at, this ra'ah, this experience. And this word ra'ah not only is an experience, but it's a respect for or respect too. And I think that once we understand that, we'll begin to change a few things. And I want to read you a book. This book was written in 1947 or 48. I want to read you something that he wrote here. And he's quoting from Gerald Massey. Gerald Massey wrote a book called I think it's the Anacalypse in 1832, I believe. 1832. So he's quoting from Alvin Boyd Kuhn is who I'm reading from, The Shadows of a Third Century. And he's quoting from the Anacalypse, which is a book that Godfrey Higgin wrote that, and Gerald Massey wrote another book about the same time. They were both prolific writers. Both of them were linguistic historians, archaeologists, etc. So they were very intelligent men. I want to read you something here out of this. He says right here in a quote, this is a quote from Higgins, "After giving the subject all the consideration in my power and a diligent examination of ancient documents for many years, I have become quite convinced that all the ancient histories were written for the sole purpose of recording a mythos." which it was desired to transmit to posterity, but yet to conceal from all but the initiate. The traditions of the countries were made subservient to this purpose, without any suspicion of fraud. And we only give them the appearance of fraud when we confound them as history. What have we done? We have confounded them in history. So what have we done? We've made them just a fraud. And that's probably, to me, one of the greatest problems that we have. Now let me read further. This is another quote from Higgins. Almost every part of Genesis is enigmatical or a parable. The system of concealment and of teaching by parable is the most marked characteristic of any truth. Did you get that? And I'm going back again, and I'm thanking God for my early teachers early on. Even though a lot of them were trying to teach me history, they were teaching me a lot of other things about mystery. And I'm going back to Dr. Fuchsia Pickett, because she hammered it into me, and I can remember it so well, 35, 36, 37 years ago, listening to her and sitting in her class, and she continually told me, she said, you have got to learn signs and symbols or you'll never know what the Old Testament scriptures are saying. If you do not understand signs and symbols. And all she was learning, all she was doing was teaching me, to say it country southern, she is learning me. She was teaching me how to extract from the Old Testament scriptures by seeing them as a mythos without her using the word mythos. She was teaching me how to see them just exactly like he says here 150 years ago, almost 200 years ago, that they were all parables. And going back to the very same thing Jesus said in Matthew 14, he said, nothing that I tell you is historical or literal. It's all parabole. So every story that he told, and these are the words, you can extract them, Matthew 14, for yourself. Jesus said, I'm not telling you anything except by parable. And Jesus told them stories about Job, didn't he? He told them stories about Jonah, didn't he? You can think it back in your mind. As well as the stories of the pearl of great price, the boy that went in the hog pen. All of those are parables. None of those were historical events. They were all parables told as a mythos to excite something inside us. And what we did is we, through chaos, we created a history out of them. And when we did, as Higgins says, then we caused them to become fraudulent. So he says, every part of Genesis is a parable. The system of concealment and of teaching by parable is the most marked characteristic of any truth. I suspect there is not a sentence in Genesis which is not consistent with good sense if its true meaning could be discovered. I feel little doubt that such a passage as that of God wounding Jacob in the thigh and his failing in his endeavor to kill Moses at an inn are wholly misunderstood. See, I was just, because if you make them a history, you do totally misunderstand them. Why would God want to kill Moses in an inn? But yet it very clearly says right there that God had set him up to send him back down there to kill him. And if you don't understand, that's not history. If you don't understand, that's a parable, then you miss the understanding of the whole. The Genesis was considered by most, if not all, of the ancient Jewish philosophers as allegory. Did you hear that? It's allegory. And so people get a little upset with me because I say that, or because I'm just saying it because I have extracted it from some of the ancient fathers and what they looked at it at. So the Bible is not a history book and never ever was meant to be a history book. This is not a history of a man meeting God on top of a mountain. This is a history of something that's happened inside you, Moses. Because you are Moses. Moshe, Moses, just simply means to be drawn up out of water. And that's what, and it, what is it all about? It's about this very thing. I showed you. It's about the experience of it. And it's generally through that experience that most of us say, wow, I don't know that I want to experience this anymore. Or we say, wow, I enjoy this experience. I would like to continue to experience this. Have you ever noticed that about yourself? Generally, that's where transformation or reformation will begin to happen in your life. When you begin to see that, you begin to recognize that. It's through the experience. And so when we look at this book, not as a history book, but we look at it as a mystery book, it'll begin to unveil. It'll begin to show us these phenomenal things that we call mysteries. So go with me now to Genesis 3. I want to show you something here where we get so far off the track. And association, what Steve was referring to, when you look at these letters and you understand the 300, the fire, the chin, you can begin to look at a lot of things in Scripture as they tie into that. And they will. They will. They'll just dovetail. In other words, you don't have to force these stories anymore to make sense. You can begin to see them and you can understand how that a Jacob can wrestle with God. In other words, you can realize that Jacob represents the physical, natural human being that has within him an Israel that wants to come forth, i.e. a prince of God, Israel. All three of those Israel, all three of those words or names comes from the En Sof or light. All three of those words, it's a word that just simply means light. Ra is another word that means light. El or al is another word that simply means light. And that light, that Israel, is in all of us. We can say grappling if we would like, but it's in there wanting to come forth, wanting to come out of this prison called a physical body. And the beauty of it is God left the door open. The prison's not locked. We think it is. If there is a lock on the door of your heart, you put it there. God never did. And if there is anything knocking at your heart, it's not trying to come in, it wants to come out. So the foolishness of what we have heard, thinking that this superhero man, Jesus, is outside me wanting to get inside me, is ridiculous. If I understood this Superman hero, Jesus, is inside me, always been inside me as me. That's why he said, as I am, you are. In this world. Because. That's why he said, you can call me brother. Why? Because he is. Because he is you. That's why he said, as the Father is, I am. And that's why he said that you should say the same thing, that I am God. People get, they get mad. All you're doing is associating yourself with the very things that the four Gospels and the story of Jesus tried to associate you with. And all we did was make it some kind of a history back there, and a special only one Son of God, not realizing that every human being was the one Son of God.
Yes.
Yes.
Scratching your head, well, if he was Israel from that day forward, then why would I be the God of Jacob forever? He is and he isn't. If you understand that Israel, that is Abraham, Isaac, Jacob.
I want to just, since you're commenting on it, let me just read the story to you. I want to make some points in it so that you can understand what's happening with this. And you understand it, you can get it better as a mythology, an allegory, a parable. All of those things associate with each other. Okay? And here's the way the story goes. It says, and Jacob was left alone, and there wrestled a man with him until, this is important, the break of day. What happens at the break of day? The light appears on the horizon, i.e., the light broke through. The importance of this parable or this analogy is to understand that when Israel, that's the symbol of light, you can say spirit, soul, and body. You can call it the triune Father, Mother, Son. You call it all of them fit simply because it's referring to all of them. And what happens is it comes alive inside you and you're no longer recognized as just a human being, i.e. Jacob, deceiver, surplanter, tricker. Now you are known as the Israel. You're known as the Luciferian light being that you really are. That's right. Now then you're known. And what happens is the light, the day breaks, and when the day breaks, here's what happens to you. I read on, and Jacob called the name of that place Peniel. Why? Because your pineal gland or your third eye opened up, and he said, that's where you meet God face to face. Where is that done? That's done in meditation. That's done in stillness. It's done when we learn to quieten ourselves, when we learn to set in that presence of awe. This whole story is so beautiful when you begin to see it not as a history, but as a myth. And when you see it as a myth, then in the story, it ignites the energy that's already in you. It's almost like God striking a match to the stick of explosion that's inside you, and you erupt with this energy of God. And you know what it does? It touches you in the hollow of your thigh, i.e. it makes your walk different. It didn't mean that you walk like a cripple anymore. It meant that now you walk by the energy of the light that comes from the hollow, the marrow, the core of who you really are. Israel. Damn, that's good. If you can get it. If you can get that, that story is just a tip of the iceberg of all of these stories. When we begin to get these stories and realize the great depth that's in these things. Why are they there? They're there so that you can be shown in the mountain of your experience, so that you can see, so that you can regard. That's what the experience is about. Now, Genesis 3:1, and we really bluttered this one up. We really have messed this one up big time. Now the serpent, Nachesh, Hebrew word, Nachesh. There are several Hebrew words that are families of words that are associated and are related to each other. And this is one of the family of those words. And you can, I'll say them for you. Nachesh. Nafech, which deals with breath. And Nafesh. Now, hear how close these words sound? Nachesh. Nafesh. Hey, let me show you something. Nachesh. You have to say that with the back of your throat. So what you do is you use the different vowel point, the five places in the linguals. That's the only way you can pronounce a Hebrew word. It's guttural. And the reason it's guttural, because it's all made by breath. The reason it's made by breath, it is ruach, i.e. God. It's God squeezing itself through you and makes these sounds. Whew. So you have to pay attention to these words. Serpent, nachesh. Breath, or breathed, nafiach. And here's a good one. Soul, nafeesh, nachesh, You hear how similar those words are? One of them is called a snake or serpent. The other one is called your soul. And this one right here, nephesh, will become a centerpiece of things that you and I begin to learn and understand when we begin to see the scriptures. And then I want to throw you a curve with this one, but you can begin to see it or you'll begin to hear it. Nafe'el. Nafe'el. Do you know what that word is? Nafe'el. You've heard it. I'm sure you have. Let me say it this way. Nephilim. You ever heard that word? That's got to resonate with some of you that's heard that. What does this mean, George? Do you hear that? See, that's how history tried to tell the mystery. But that's not who the Nephilim or the Nephilim are. They're called giants. That's how they're listed in Scripture. But the reason they're listed there, because remember, we're not talking about history, so David wasn't really facing some 14-foot character. What was David facing? He was facing a thought in his mind that was 14 foot high. Have you ever faced one? You are right now. In your experience in life where you are right now. And do you know what you have to learn to do with the Nephilim or the Nephilims? You have to learn that it's the grace of God in you that slays that thought. Now, I am not saying that we have not been visited by aliens. And I am not saying that the possibility of aliens are creatures that could be much bigger in stature than we are. But when Scripture is referring to, and again, I'm going back to the very things that I'm saying, it's not a history. And we get so tripped up by trying to make it a history, we go back and we try to make these Hebrew words literal characters of beings, i.e. a Moses, i.e. a Jacob, i.e. a giant that come from another planet. The Nephilim. Just go on the internet and just Google it. You can find all kinds of bizarre and weird information. It comes out of a piece of material that has more expansion on it than the Bible. And it's a book that dates back to about the time of the first five books of the Bible. 3,500 years or so. And I'm going to read from that. Well, I'm going to show you the book. I'm not going to read from it this morning, maybe. But I want to read from some other things, and I just want you to see some things that I'm talking about, because I'm talking about the serpent, which is an energy system that swirls in your spinal column. It's called your nerve center. And it's through your nerve center that you have all of the experiences that you have in life, right? It's through your nerve center. It's your nerve center that gives you the exterior senses. See, smell, taste, touch, and hear, right? That's how you experience everything. So that's not good, bad, right, or wrong unless you determine it to be that way. Right? Yeah, okay. So I'm going to read something else to you here from Alvin Boyd Kuhn, especially since I said that about the Nephilim, because those are words I'm not going to put them on the board this morning. I spell all these words. The Nachesh, the Nafeach, the Nashama, the Nefesh, and the Nafeel. All of these words are spelled very, very similar. And when you see them in Hebrew as they're spelling, then you begin to see association. And that's what I want you to see or hear, is association with these words, because they have to do with different experiences that you have. Different experiences that come to you. And you can call them good, or you can call them bad, or you can call them right, or you can call them wrong. But in truth and reality, they are experiences. And so if we go back and we make these things history, we will truly miss the mystery. And they were never meant to be a history. They were meant to be a mystery. Okay, this is from a writing, let me see where, here we go. An instance out of hundreds comes to hand at a moment in what is said in the classical journey. That was a magazine or writings, to the effect that 600,000 warriors of the Israelite multitude that reportedly came out of Egypt in the Exodus are 600,000 inhabitants of Israel in the heavens, according to Jewish Kabbalah, and the same scene, events, and personages that appear as mundane in the Pentateuch are celestial in the book of Enoch. Now, what did he say when he said that? He said the things that you read in the Bible that you consider history, i.e. 600,000 men, not counting women and children, in your historical Bible about an exodus of a historical people out of a historical Egypt, which never were meant to be an exit of historical people out of a historical Egypt. The book of Enoch had recorded them before that as celestial beings in the astrological belt. That's what he's saying right here. That they were considered as celestial in the book of Enoch. In another work, we have presented the demonstrable conclusion of Gerald Massey's study that among ancient peoples, the localities, names, characters, titles of kings, heroes, and others were all taken from the original zodiacal or astrological charts of the heavens and transplanted to maps, to earthly histories, to personages of national renown. History and geography were alike framed over the pattern shown in the mountain, the pattern of the heavens. So what in the world was he seeing that he had an experience with? He was seeing as above, so below. And he was understanding that what he was experiencing was within himself. It is always meant to be that way. History and geography were alike framed over the pattern shown in the mountain, the pattern of the heavens. The universal ancient custom is the key at once to all the mythic religion of the past and the conclusive seal of non-historical character of the scriptural narratives. Just simply saying that those stories, just like if you're reading about the 600,000 men, women, and children, you can read about them here in Enoch, and they were always celestial beings. They were not a historical group of people moving from Egypt to the Canaan land. They were astrological beings moving in the heavens. And what were they doing? They were recording energy. So when you read the book of Enoch, which is extremely hard to read because it's symbolic, mythical language that goes into such... I was going to read you something, but it's not an easy read. I'll give it that. It's pretty hard read. So when it comes back to... everything that I'm really saying this morning, it comes back to this circle, the Ein Sof actually being this circle, the union of spirit and ego, the union of God and man. And God put within man the key or the key, I'll use the word key, he put within man the key to unlock all of these mysteries, which is your soul. And the soul is not your spirit, but it's as much like your spirit as it can be. Your soul is not your ego, but it's as much like your ego as it can be. And so learning that and learning to see that, learning to choose, I guess I could say it this way, you learn to choose your battles. Because there are many that you don't need to enter into because you will lose. But when you learn that you can choose those battles, then you can win. When you realize that you are a David and that you have the grace of God, then you get your five smooth stones and you go against your Nephilim. You go against your Goliath, which is a thought that you have that you think is real. How many of you have them? Everybody?
experiencing them with your five senses or your five smooth stones.
You sure are. Just all keeps, gets deeper and deeper, doesn't it? Amen.
No questions? No comments? Everybody got any good of that?
Yeah.
It's all about words you haven't heard. It's ever been about making the two one. That's what the marriage is. The marriage is not about a man and a woman trying to make life work, but it can't. It's about making your soul and ego work together. It's about you marrying your heaven and your earth. When there's peace in your world, then the chaos about the things around you do not have to destroy the peace in your world. Doesn't mean that there will be chaos around you. It just simply means now that you have something by which a substance in your very being that you can handle that. Otherwise, it can give you a headache.
Yeah, you gave me enough to think about now. I know I'm going to go home and throw the CD in. I'm going to watch The Last Samurai again.
We just watched The Last Samurai a week before last.
Great movie.
It is a phenomenal movie.
If you want to look at the levels that it's really speaking to.
Yeah. It is phenomenal. It really is.
Did you watch The Last Samurai?
Jesus said, don't look here, don't look there. The kingdom of God is inside you. He also said, the insult, the nothingness is inside you, from which life itself emerges. It comes out of us. It doesn't happen to us. We cause it to happen, and our happening as the now coincides with the here.
That's why that this is a hard thing to say, and I don't really know how to say it gracefully other than just to say it, is because just exactly what George said, the insult is always in you. I mean, from the very moment that you were pushed out of the womb of your mom, the Garden of Eden, from the very moment that you were pushed out, and that first inhalation, the ruach, that was already the construction of your building. You were built by God. But now then, you live and breathe as God. And that's what happened when that created in soul, life, earth, is now resident inside you. Can't not be. So it's not something you invite there. It's there, always been there. And it is a creative energy that is not, how can I say, this is what's so hard to say. It's a creative energy that's designed to just create. Therefore, if you are living from this ego aspect of your life, it can and generally always does create a lot of hell. Or chaos, or pain, or dumb bullshit. It can and does create that. And in essence, that's God creating that stuff. But He's doing it through you because that's how you are drawing it forth. And once we figure that out, we see that, we can begin to create it different. We are creators. And we do create our world. And it's so hard to take responsibility for that and for yourself. It's so hard to do that. We always want to blame somebody. It was done to me. Or they did it. Or. But in reality, we did it to ourselves. And it's hard to take blame or hard to take responsibility and not place blame. And that's a difficult thing to say and even probably harder to receive. Because, you know, most people say, well, it wasn't my fault.
I don't know if I'll be able to say this right, but, some, you know, in our former life, there was things we didn't accomplish. Well, we had a chance to do it again. And sometimes it takes something really hard for you to finally accomplish what it is that you didn't accomplish in your last, your former life. Because you get so tired. You get so tired and say, hey, man, I don't want that anymore. You know, you finally learn, hey, this is not it. And
right.
You finally accomplish, and you finally see, hey, this ain't for me. And so that's accomplished. Now you don't got to take it into your next life.
Amen.
We can't see into the place from which life is emerging. This very second, the life is emerging in this place, is emerging with all of us in the here, all of us in the presence, all of us in that in tiny bit of time, which is the doorway through which our life emerges. We can't see into where it's coming from. All we know is that we've heard your voices, seen a lot of things on the board, but we don't really understand where, out of which that came. It seems to have come out of you, but it came out of us.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, because when anyone is teaching by the Spirit, they're not really showing you anything that you don't know. They're causing you to remember already what you know.
That's right.
So you already knew it. It was in you. It didn't come out of me. It come out of you. Simply because you knew it. And what it does, it connects the dots for us. And those connecting of those dots many times helps us to remember. So it pulls it back up out of us. That, because that's where it's at. Yeah. Okay.